This is KCBX, Central Coast Public Radio, here on NPR One. Underwriting support for Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer is provided by Nashville's Big Backyard, a nonprofit economic initiative focused on rural destinations along the fabled Natchez National Parkway.
I'm Lori McCandish King, reporting from San Francisco, California. I'm delighted to be visiting today with George Jacob, the visionary president and CEO of Bay Ecotarium, a not-for-profit that manages seven local institutions, including the Aquarium of the Bay here at Pier 39. Welcome, George.
Thank you.
You are currently directing a $260 million project that will transform the Smithsonian-affiliated Aquarium of the Bay into something called the Climate Resilience and Ocean Conservation Living Museum. What does that mean?
So the Aquarium of the Bay on Pier 39 has been there for about 25 years. And we did a technical audit on the infrastructure and determined that it was time to upgrade the building. And in doing so, we saw an opportunity of transforming the aquarium into a climate resilience and ocean conservation living museum, which essentially means that at the core of it is the aquarium with an increased capacity for holding animals and holding salt water from our current levels of 750,000 gallons to up it to nearly 1.5 to 1.75 million gallons of water and adding 30,000 animals, which is an upgrade from our current number of animals. And then using the ocean as a lens to talk about ocean conservation and climate change.
What about the living part? What does that mean, a living museum?
Like I mentioned, it involves live animals in our care. We'll probably have close to 300 species of live animals in our care. And the second part of the living entity is its biomimetic facade. So we are going to create a wall of microalgae to generate power in parts of the building. And that biomimetic facade adds to the living nature of the building itself.
And there also will be a capability for harvesting oysters. Is that right?
That's true. On the north side of the building, we would create oyster trays, which can be eventually harvested. So it's a living oyster farm happening on the premise, and that certainly adds to the living part of the climate museum.
And then in contrast to that living part, there's also this high-tech aspect where you've got AR, VR, and XR capabilities and cyber curation of live data streams. Could you talk a little bit about those aspects?
The complex is divided into three separate parcels. We have the central building, which holds the Aquarium of the Bay with climate immersive exhibits. The second part actually extends into the ocean, and that holds a deep ocean exploration lab as well as a theater space. And then there's a third bubble, which is a machine learning device, which extends the cyber footprint of the organization to virtual audiences that transcend geopolitical boundaries. So not only do we have exhibits that use tech platforms in innovative ways, but we also have a mother portal with live streaming data that educates people about carbon tracking and other live data streams that have contributed to global warming and climate change.
And I think I understand that visitors themselves can participate in this data collection. How does that work?
So it's an extension of citizen science contribution towards creating a metadata. And the cyber portal that we have in between the two large bubbles of the building is also extended to multiple locations and airports around the world, and where citizens can actually populate multiple streams of data, which can then be vetted and filtered and then contribute to the larger visual mapping of certain streams of data.
I didn't get that. What kind of data?
Let's take a look at a bridge which has vehicular traffic. Image recognition allows us to determine today the make and the shape of trucks and cars and scooters and motorcycles on, let's say, a bridge. That allows us to calibrate the carbon emissions of the kinds of different models of vehicles that move on that bridge. And on an hourly basis, one can have data that indicates the carbon emissions just on that stretch of the bridge, depending on the kind of vehicles that have moved on it. And that is live data. And to explain the complexity of carbon emissions, one can use that as a tracker. And then the tracker can be translated into an illustrative file. And it can show up in easy ways to understand that traffic on that single bridge during rush hours or slow hours amounts to a certain emission level of carbon. So that's just one example of how one can visualize the increasing or decreasing carbon levels on one single stretch of the road.
Oh, I get it. Okay, that's very cool. So this isn't just a reimagined aquarium. A climate museum is something completely different. Some exhibits sort of added to a traditional aquarium. It's a whole rethinking. Could you talk a little bit about that process?
So a number of natural history museums, both in this country and elsewhere, have addressed climate change in different ways. And there is a new Museum of the Future coming up in Dubai that opens later this year that will also address aspects of climate change. Quite often what happens is that it gets reduced to images of forest fires or cyclones or hurricanes or zones that have submerged pieces of land and some data that goes with it. That's been the conventional method of sharing information on climate change in many museum galleries. What would be different in the Equatorium would, of course, be the immersive nature of the exhibitory. You're not just passive observers, but you can actually participate in collective experiences. You can look at scenario building where you control different variables that contribute to climate change or accelerate or decelerate climate change. And then you can look at scenarios 50, 100, 200 years from now on the impact that certain variables would have on climate change or on this planet. And also the price of inaction. What is the price of not doing anything can also be built as a scenario, an immersive scenario that contributes to the exhibit experience.
I love that concept, the price of not doing anything. We talk so much about the price of mitigating climate change and how it's so expensive and can we really afford it? And people don't talk about the price of not doing anything. I think that's such an important aspect to bring to the conversation. I'm really happy to hear that that's going to be part of it. What's the timing, by the way, for this? It's a gigantic project.
So it is a complex project, more complex because of live animals and life support systems that back living organisms in the premise and some of the standards that we have to adhere to when we hold live animals. But apart from that, the complexity lies in the environmental impact statement and the permitting process that can often take a fairly long time in San Francisco. But the execution part, because it is a prefab, is fairly quick. Our intention is to execute the job in 24 to 30 months.
You'll be telling the story of climate change, at least partly through the eyes and voice of Native Americans. Why did you decide that that was an important thing to do?
That's a story that often gets ignored. We bury ourselves in a deluge of data, and the human cost, the evocativeness of storytelling gets completely lost. But the important element is to remember that Native Americans have been stewards of this land for hundreds of years, and they have always lived in symbiotic harmony with nature. And they were the first stewards of climate and environmental sustainability anywhere. So it is only appropriate that we give credence to those voices and let them narrate the story of why it is important to sustain this beautiful planet we call home.
How does that work? Do you have relationships with Native American individuals or tribes or councils? How does that get integrated?
We are in early conversations with the Ohlone, the Miwok, the Chumash, the Yokuts, the Chichone Indians. And these conversations have centered around this meta-narrative on how to take care of this planet that is already scarred in so many different ways and how to reverse the tide. And what does it entail in terms of making certain personal sacrifices with our own habits of consumption and reduction of carbon emissions and being sensitive to the vanishing habitats of animals that form this complex web of biodiversity in our ecosystems? And with that intent, we began engaging them in creative ways to tell the story. So as you enter the primary building of the Equatorium, you are actually entering through a digital waterfall. And the waterfall is essentially a holographic projection that narrates the story in a combination of prose and poetry.
You've called the Equatorium a receptacle for the narrative of environmental consciousness. What does that mean?
We forget that we live on a fragile planet. There are consequences to the Anthropocene that we have seen only accelerating in the last 100 years, and more so in the last 50 years. To be conscious of the consequences of our singular or collective actions is, I think, at the heart of the storytelling at the Equatorium. Awareness is that keystone which encourages us to take action. So if we are not aware of what the problem is, it is very difficult to figure out how to mitigate the problem. And that seems to be overwhelmingly large. How do you reverse the ebb and flow of excessive carbon that is being sequestered by certain other parts of the world, whether it's the Amazon forest or the kelp forest below the surface of the water?
It does seem like there's just an overwhelming amount that we need to do, and we need to do it so quickly. I'm wondering, why spend $260 million on a museum? Would that be better spent on direct action? How do you think about that?
So that's a very good question. As you know, there are hundreds of agencies focused on sustainability around the world. There are regulatory agencies that work with UN agencies and recommendations to make sure that certain standards and certain processes are followed in a certain way. There has been a simplification of this very complex problem into 17 areas of action under the UN Sustainable Development Goals, SDG program. And, you know, different agencies that have the expertise and capability to handle one or more aspects of the SDG goals have been dedicating more and more resources towards those activities. There is also an increased realization of how these 17 realms are connected. Part of the mandate of the Equatorium is to bring forth that awareness in compelling ways so that we become ambassadors of change. You know, we talk about spending $800 million on homeless or $1 billion on homeless. What happens if we don't have a home on this planet? So I think $200 million for creating a capital hub of awareness is a very small price to spur and trigger collective action.
In 2017, you said, museums are the souls of civil societies, and they serve as repositories of our collective memory. I love that, George. I'm such a museum nerd, and I sometimes feel like better to be outside doing things than inside a museum, poking around. But now I realize why they're so compelling. It is because they are the soul of a civilization. One final question. What do you mean when you ask us to be the movement?
It is a quote that has been in circulation for a while, that you be the change that you want. Being the movement is about changing your own lifestyle. It's about making certain personal choices, whether it's your eating habits or consumer habits, or encouraging organizations that adhere to sustainable practices and supporting 360 circular economies. So when one becomes aware that these are important steps that contribute to reduction of carbon footprint, then you become the movement by taking some of those adaptations in your personal lifestyle. It also means that collectively, one can exercise one's intellect and precipitate changes in policy. It also means applying your inventive minds to prototyping innovative solutions that are engineering-based that can tackle some of these problems, whether it's a Tesla car or a green-powered ship. They're all contributors to this human ingenuity of working towards effective solutions. It could also mean environmental engineering, whether it's creation of horizontal levees or restoration of marshlands or preserving of mangroves that act as natural filters and preserving kelp forests and not raking up the bottom of the oceans for deep sea mining, etc.
You mentioned that one of the reasons you like being here in San Francisco in close proximity to Silicon Valley is that you can work with scientists and visionary entrepreneurs and creators. This jumped out at me. And creators of emotional artificial intelligence. What is that? What's emotional AI?
It's the cognitive ability of AI to adapt to certain emotive circumstances. So the more and more sophisticated data mapping can yield a more sensitive response from a machine learning device. And that can be sometimes in sync with your emotional state. There are programs that understand your facial expressions and offer cues and prompts that address your emotional state. And as AI becomes more sophisticated, the conversation with the human being will appear more seamless and in tune with somebody's emotional state. And in that state, one can actually have a back and forth that is more effective, more convincing, more meaningful in that sense that you're trying to tap into the urgency, immediacy, or emotional state of a potential user.
This is kind of a new concept for me, and I think it's fascinating. Just to be even more specific, what would that be like if I were just a visitor coming into the Ecotarium, and let's say at one exhibit, I don't know what, raise my eyebrows and look interested, or at another one, maybe I turn away and begin to move away from the exhibit. Are those the kinds of things that would trigger a particular response that would actually come from the exhibit and interact with me?
So potentially it could look at, let's say, a particular species of animal. And let's say whether you're watching a jellyfish or a sea bass and it evokes a certain response in you. You feel happy seeing that particular animal. Or when you see a shark, you feel a sense of fear. And the EAI will react to that state and will try to allay your fears by saying, you know, shark is a sensitive animal. Yes, it has been demonized in movies, but left to itself, it minds its own business, et cetera, et cetera. So it reacts to one's emotional state and responds to addressing that emotional state in intelligent ways.
That is so cool. I can't wait to try it. We've been visiting today with George Jacob. He's president and CEO of the Bay Ecotarium in San Francisco. Thank you, George.
You're welcome. It's wonderful chatting with you.
I'm Lori McCandish King, reporting from San Francisco, California.
Underwriting support for Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer is provided by Nashville's Big Backyard, a nonprofit economic initiative focused on rural destinations along the fabled Natchez National Parkway. With a focus on rural communities, such as Leaper's Fork, not far from Nashville, the Big Backyard journey traverses through Tennessee's southwest quarter down into Alabama's legendary Shoals region, the mothership of American music. The featured rural community's common thread is historic architecture and a timeless, charming small-town atmosphere, some with a river running through it. The diverse attractions of the featured communities include the amazing Elephant Sanctuary in Hohenwald, where retired circus elephants come to retire in peace, and iconic destinations like Northern Alabama's Shoals region, where you'll find one of America's most iconic Frank Lloyd Wright homes and two of America's legendary recording studios that have been etching American soundtracks since the early 1960s. For example, Muscle Shoals Sound Studios in Sheffield, Alabama, opened in 1969, instantly started marking up the charts with number one hits by recording artists like the Rolling Stones, Willie Nelson, Wilson Pickett, Linda Ronstadt, Rod Stewart, and Paul Simon. Nashville's Big Backyard's ardent promoters include Mike Wolff, host of History Channel's American Pickers TV series, who provides a surgical contextual lens focused on Nashville's Big Backyard's diverse initiatives, and Liz McLaurin, president of the Land Trust for Tennessee, an equally passionate supporter of Nashville's Big Backyard's greater good elements through the Land Trust preservation initiatives. To learn more about the program, log on to nashvillesbigbackyard.org.
You've been listening to the Lowell Thomas award-winning travel show Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer, a featured podcast on NPR.org's podcast directory. Produced by California Central Coast NPR affiliate KCBX. You are invited to subscribe to Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer on NPR.org, NPR One, iTunes, Stitcher.com, and more than 20 other podcast channels around the world. To learn more about Tom Wilmer's journeys around America and the world, log on to thomaswilmer.com.
My name is Roseanne Cash. I listen to WNYC in New York. In fact, NPR is all I listen to. And if I didn't have NPR, I would feel like my lifeline to the world has been cut. So, yes, please support your local NPR station.